Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming-higher-education. This message was paid for by EY.
This is The Guardian.
Rishi Sunak began his spring statement by talking about the war in Ukraine. Why? Because he wants us to think about the rising cost of living as part of a bigger international crisis.
But Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living.
The Chancellor made one big announcement.
The basic rate of income tax will be cut from 20 to 19 pence in the pound.
But that's not coming into effect until 2024. What really stood out for me is that there was strikingly little help or action for people who were really struggling. Something that really, really meets the crisis people are facing and offers us at least a glimmer of hope that was sadly lacking. I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are Miatta Farnbulla, Chief Executive of the New Economics Foundation, and David Gawp, the former MP, Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and briefly, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. Hello to you both.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for having us on.
Now, we're recording this episode shortly after Rishi Sunak's spring statement. We'll talk more about his performance and the substance of that later. I just wanted to ask you briefly about what preceded this, which is a sort of minor Instagram frenzy. The government seems very keen on putting up slightly sort of corny, cringeworthy images of ministers. And there were a couple went up of him reading about himself in the Mail on Sunday, I think. And then mysteriously sitting there in front of 18 sheets of paper all lined up on a table.
It's so mortifying. It's really cringeworthy.
Really mortifying. Is it that bad?
I just can't bear it. It's that awful thing of trying to look authentic but being like the least authentic thing in the world. I can't imagine the sort of thing you'd have done, David.
Well, no, certainly not.
You or anyone?
Well, when I was in the Treasury, there was one budget where Philip Hammond was the Chancellor, and there was a picture of him holding a cup of tea and looking at the Red Book. And that was released. And we all thought it was hilarious. So all the junior ministers in the Treasury then posed holding cups of tea and Red Book looking at it. And I think we...
But this wasn't sort of personal Instagram branding on the scale that we're seeing now.
Philip Hammond, not big of personal Instagram
branding. No, I can't
Instagram
imagine
branding.
He's big on the ground.
It's not his scene, so no. I mean, the big thing that we always used to have for budgets was the photograph outside Downing Street.
Did you have 18 sheets of paper mysteriously lined up on a table?
No, we never did that. No, we did used to have to rehearse to go outside Downing Street. So you'd get a rehearsal, so we'd all line up and pose, and all the ministers would look there for about 10 seconds, and then we would walk off, leaving the Chancellor on his own. But the first time I did this in sort of 2010, we went out, there's loads and loads of photographers there, and George Osborne held up the box. We all stood there, and I was at the end, and it was my job to sort of count to 10 and say, let's go, which we did. But I was standing next to Danny Alexander, and he'd never seen so many cameras before in his life.
Of course,
as a Liberal
Democrat.
Yeah, quite. So anyway, I ended up wandering off on my own, and Paul, so I had to go back and collect Danny and the rest of them. It was a shambles, but there we go.
No, that's endearing. I'd rather have a shambles than this level of sort of Instagram nonsense. Now, laughter and absurdity aside, today we're going to look at the cost of living crisis, starting with Rishi Sunak's spring statement, what he had to say, and then we'll move into a bigger conversation about big issues and why so many people in Britain are so vulnerable to the cost of living crisis. Now, before we get into the spring statement, I'm going to have a chat with someone I've been in touch with on and off for years, Robin Burgess, from the Hope Centre in Northampton, which helps people experiencing some of the most acute problems of disadvantage and poverty The Hope Centre provides advice services, it does campaigning work, and crucially and most pressingly, it helps people with food. Robin,
hiya.
How does what you're faced with now compare to previous years? In other words, what's the pattern over time? I mean, you've been at the Hope Centre for a fair while, so just give me a sense about how levels of need have changed maybe over 5, 10, 15 years.
So, you know, whenever you have a big crisis or a big recession, like we had, for example, in the early 80s when I cut my teeth as a young social worker, you know, that was when it was very acute, and we are back there again. And we hit again another peak during COVID. But there was an attempt at alleviating those problems then by government with the uplift to universal credit. None of that is in place now. And we're at the same time facing the greatest cost of living crisis that we've seen in possibly those 40 years of my career. So we're now seeing a level of poverty created by rising fuel prices, rising food prices, and everything else that's going up, including, let's not forget, housing and transport costs, that there will be millions more people, literally millions more people, thrown into destitution over the next couple of years.
The biggest cost of living crisis in the 40 years
yeah.
that you've done the kind of work you do.
Yeah.
How do you feel watching that play out in front of you?
Well, it's terrifying. I mean, we saw it when COVID hit. Let's be under no illusions. All those people who lost their jobs, a huge upsurge in people accessing food aid, food banks, kind of things that we run. And that was massive. It'll be worse again this time because you have the added impacts of all the fuel stuff.
What are people going to do, do you think?
It may sound sensationalist, it may sound crude, may sound bullying. People will starve or freeze. Some will do both. And that's the reality. There will be people who will not have enough to eat and will go hungry. And they will be ill, both psychologically and physically, as a result of that. You know, it's not just me saying that. People like Jack Monroe, brilliant campaigners, have been making those cases really strongly. People like Martin Lewis, the comparison site guy, has been doing fantastic work saying the same thing. This is not just scaremongering. This is not shroud waving. This is the reality of the life, the lives of the people that we work with.
What did you make of what the Chancellor announced today, seen from your perspective?
Well, I mean, if you look this morning, you will see hundreds of charities, mine included, posting their messages to the Chancellor saying, please, please do something for the very poorest. And he didn't. He gave a piece of money to go into local authority coffers to alleviate one-off payments, 500 million. Now, that may sound like a lot of money. You boil that down to a local level and it's a few thousand. And there are thousands of people going to be in desperate poverty. It will not touch the sides, as people have been saying since the announcement, of all the need that's out there. He could have raised universal credit levels in line with inflation. He chose not to do so. There is no systemic help for the very poorest in any of these statements. There is a one-off grant scheme that will be totally inadequate to address the need that there is. This is a totally wasted opportunity. And the only money that's been put in is really for those who pay tax, who will see some sort of minor reductions in a couple of years. But the poorest and the next poorest will get nothing.
4 or 5 years ago, Jacob Rees-Mogg, as we both know, is in the cabinet, was talking about food banks and provision for people experiencing food poverty. And he said, to have charitable support given by people voluntarily to support their citizens, I think is rather uplifting and shows what a good, compassionate country we are. And he said, the real reason for the rise in numbers of people using food banks or needing food banks is that people know they are there and Labour deliberately didn't tell them. That's the sort of message we hear from time to time from people in charge. How did you feel, or do you feel, about that?
It is ridiculous to assume that the charitable sector, charities like mine and all the others replicating what we do all up and down the country, it is ridiculous to assume that we can, however uplifting our work is, match that tide of need and hurt that people on the poorest incomes will be experiencing. There is nothing uplifting about receiving some charity from an organisation like us. It may be kind and it may be may help, but it is not enough to mitigate against those cuts.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Robin. Really, really appreciated as ever, and all the best. Obviously, this is a really, really difficult time for you, but more importantly, for the people that you help. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, I talk to Robin every sort of 2-3 months, really, to get a sense of what's going on. And I think the telling thing is that I'm not talking to someone in the sort of place that might be understood as a byword for poverty. I mean, Northampton's sort of, you would think of as socially and economically middling, you know. And yet there he is talking about people starving and freezing. And instinctively, you know, there were certain points in that conversation where I had my head in my hands. And that's sort of at once removed. He's sort of faced with that every day. I mean, it's amazing that there are people like him around to do what they do. Part of me wonders how they sort of carry on, really. But he really was talking about looking ahead 2, 3, 4 months, 2 or 3 years, as this cost of living crisis mounts, and feeling scared, really, by what he's faced with. I just wonder what you felt hearing it, really.
I mean, look, it's desperate stuff. And I think the thing that is heartbreaking is that it's a story you're hearing over and over again across the country. And it's not the people who, by the way, have been like hammered and suffering for a really long time. It's the fact that it's creeping up the income scales, and it is desperate. You know, I'm actually fuming that in one of the richest countries in the world, we've got ourselves in a situation where you got people who are having to make a choice between not eating, not feeding their kids and heating their homes. It's just not good enough. It is not good enough.
I mean, David, he said that it's not even, or it's gone beyond the point now that people are choosing between eating and heating. It's that they're suffering both.
I have to say, as a hard-bitten former Tory Treasury minister, I felt that more should have been done for those people in this spring statement. And I think in terms of sort of prioritising, you know, the whole country is about to face a difficult period of time. And, you know, the average household is likely to lose something like £1,000as a consequence of inflation. But I would have focused, I have to say, today on those people at the bottom.
Can I ask a question? Because, I mean, you know, I'm a bleeding heart liberal, so of course, you know, this would impact me. And of course, for me, it was a no-brainer that he had to help the people at the sharp end. And I a lot of the time, you know, I can look at government decisions and I can rationalise it and I can say, well, it's not the decision I'd make, but I understand it. And I generally don't understand. And is it just that they don't really know what's going on in the country? Is it that they're just not seeing that scale of suffering when people are saying, there is nothing else I can do? I've every avenue to just try to get by, I have exhausted. Is it that they're not seeing it? They don't believe that it's as desperate as it is? I don't understand.
Well, I do wonder whether, particularly if we see the energy cap go up again in October, which looks far more likely than not, as to whether the government is going to be forced to come back with something more generous at that bottom.
But why not now, when things are as stark? As Robin told us, and Mia just reiterated, and you yourself have said, yeah, that you're sort of surprised by the absence of measures to help people who are really suffering. Why is there that absence, do you think?
I think it's a fair question, and you know, if I attempt to explain it rather than justify it, I mean, look, there is always a viewpoint that, you know, the best way that you can help people is to help them into work, and that you can encourage them to work more hours, and, you know, that is the sustainable route out of poverty. And I think there's a lot in that. I don't shy away from that argument at all. And, you know, there are always questions about cost and what you can afford, and you know, can we, as an economy, there are lots of demands on public spending, and sure, do you have to make some sort of tough choices?
But there are blind spots here in the moment, aren't there?
I think this is failing to appreciate quite what the circumstances are. And I say that as someone who was in a government that took some very tough decisions on benefits and welfare. But I do think, you know, you look at what is happening to prices, which was not an issue when I was in government, and you think, you know, more help needs to be done.
Right. Talking of which, let's get into the substance or lack of it in what the Chancellor had to say and what he announced in terms of hard policy. One of Sunak's announcements was a 5p cut in the rate of fuel duty.
For only the second time in 20 years, fuel duty will be cut. Yeah. Not by one, not even by two, but by 5p per litre. Yeah.
It's the market trader school of rhetoric. Not one, not two, but five. So that was one measure he announced. He announced some help with energy costs in a sort of roundabout way. He's going to cut VAT on such energy-saving devices as heat pumps and so on. He has announced that the Household Support Fund, which is a measure that was brought in after the backlash against the end of the uplift to universal credit, that was initially £500 million a year administered by local councils. That load of money ends this month, March 2022. The next phase of that will see the amount doubling to £1 billion, but that's discretionary help that people have to specifically apply for to help poorer families. He also said that the national insurance threshold was raised by £3,000 to £12,570. And in the most sort of headline-grabbing but not immediate bit of what he announced, he said he's going to cut the basic rate of income tax from 20% to 19%, but not until 2024. David, first of all, what did you make of those measures?
I think the curious one is the income tax cut in 2024, because he started off his speech quoting the OBR, or the Office for Budget Responsibility, saying this is a period of high uncertainty and they haven't fully factored in the Ukraine war, and the numbers could substantially move in the wrong direction. So he says that, and then he makes a promise for a cut in income tax in 2 years' time. He's got three fiscal events between now and then, which he could have used to announce this. And I just think it's sort of really strange in a period of uncertainty in the public finances that you're committing yourself to a tax cut at this point. And I can only think that that's designed to appeal to Conservative MPs and the Tory press.
But this is just the weekly bit of so-called red meat that this somewhat panicked and nervy government seems to feel duty-bound to throw the backbenches, right?
Yeah, and that's partly what worries me, that it did sound a little bit panicked, and it did sound as if Rishi Sunak has heard all the accusations. Yeah, he's a high-tax chancellor.
Highest tax burden since 1945.
All of that sort of stuff, and he's sort of worried and thought, well, I better get rid of that reputation as quickly as possible, whereas if he'd been thinking, you know, what's my plan over the next 2 years? Well, I'll announce this later, assuming that the numbers allow me to do so. So I think it undermines his fiscal credibility.
Okay, that's the sort of high politics. As regards the effect on people's everyday lives, let's talk about that as a sort of context for the measures that were announced today. Yeah. So how much help, if any, does this give
some,
people who need help?
Some, but not enough for those who need it. And for me, that income tax announcement just felt really tone deaf. It's like, against the backdrop of what people are feeling for the next 6 months, year and a half, why are we talking about a tax cut in, you know, 2 years' time? It seems really odd. And then you look at the things that he's doing now. So you take that fuel duty. I was expecting a 15p cut, which would be something, but that...
£3, I've just read, off a full tank of petrol.
Well, it's exactly. So, and the worst part of it is for the lowest income households, actually only about 7% of the benefits flow to them because they use less fuel, versus the highest, if you take the highest 20% of households, that's about 33% of the benefits flow to them. So like £1.80 a month for the lowest households. It just doesn't stack up. And it's the national insurance threshold. The thing that I'm struggling with is that actually, why it costs £6 billion? Why didn't he use that £6 billion to upgrade Social Security, which wouldn't have meant, you know, £1,000?
£6 billion. Correct me if I'm wrong. Was the value of the uplift to universal credit?
£20 uplift, £1,000 a year. So £300, which will be going to higher income households, versus £1,000 to people who are literally struggling to feed their kids or heat their homes.
And these are choices. Let's do the choices.
It is about choices. And, you know, in some respects, he set the dividing line. You know, he set the dividing line in terms of the story he wanted to tell on tax, but also where his relative priority were. And it's whether it's a strategy that the politics will pay off for him. I'm not sure.
Tough choices is a sort of political cliche. I wanted to talk about tough choices in the context of people's everyday lives. One person in particular. On Tuesday, I spoke to someone I've spoken to before about the cost of living. I spoke to her in January. She lives in rural North Wales and she writes diary entries under the pseudonym Lexi for a project called COVID Realities, which was initially about everyday life in the pandemic. But the people who've organised it have extended it now because of the cost of living crisis. And the woman I'm talking about lives with her husband, who used to work in construction until fairly recently. He's currently unemployed. She's disabled. They have four kids, four sons. They live 2 miles from the nearest bus stop and they rely on oil for their central heating and hot water. And the last time they had the heating on, she told me, on Tuesday, it was in November. Their oil tank at the moment is running low. And she's just been told that the price of 500 litres of oil has gone up from £235 to £480. It's more than doubled. The family's electricity bill is about to go up from £1,851.15 to £2,564.33 annually. She transferred to Universal Credit a while ago and there was a 9-week wait. And she's still paying back debts on her bills from that time. Now, it would be easy to think she's living at the social edges. In point of fact, there are lots and lots of people living in comparably difficult, impossible circumstances. You know, I don't think that's at all a sort of freakish set of occurrences. And I didn't hear anything in the spring statement for people like her. I mean, that's the point both of you have made throughout the conversation up to now. The obvious thing to do would have been to put up Universal Credit by more than 3.1%, which is the current rate, which gets us back to the conversation we started fitfully a moment ago. Why not do that, David?
I think that's a really good question. And I think, you know, when you've got inflation moving, as it was from, you know, 3% in September, and now it's going to be 8% in April, yeah, that's a big jump. And that seems to me the obvious thing to have done, to have brought that forward. One of the issues that I've no doubt that they worry about in the Treasury is about reversibility. In other words, if you do, you know, short-term help to get through the surge in inflation.
Like the household support fund.
Yeah, and so hence you've got, you know, one-off payments like the household support fund is exactly the type of thing that you could do because it's easy to withdraw it. And one of the issues with the Universal Credit uplift, you know, it was very popular and welcomed when it was introduced, and then the government had a whole host of pain when it was withdrawn. And they
should never have been withdrawn. There was a sentence I read in The Economist magazine this week in a piece about Rishi Sunak. It said, as for raising benefits, Conservatives dislike nothing more. I ask you this because you're a Conservative. That's true, isn't it? And I wonder why it's true.
I think that's probably is true. But I tell you why, and I think something, a number of issues which I think are wrong here. There is the sort of mindset that increasing benefits automatically results in sort of increasing, you know, people being dependent and so on. And I think this is in part a failure to properly embrace the reforms that involved in Universal Credit. Now, I'm a defender of UC, and I think, you know, a system whereby we are more generous with the money that we hand out, but we also expect more from UC claimants, and we ensure that, you know, that works whether you're out of work or in work. And a heck of a lot of UC claimants are in work. And it is not an out-of-work benefit. It is not there to sort of encourage dependency. It is designed to provide support to people who need it and to help them into work.
But even you as a Conservative would agree that notwithstanding everything that you've just said, there is an element of the sort of collective Conservative mind which teeters into cruelty sometimes in its refusal to countenance the idea of putting benefits up, particularly in a crisis like this.
Well, as I say, I think they should put benefits up. The argument will be, you know, we can't just borrow away and support living standards forever and you know, pay people to stay at home. But Universal Credit doesn't pay people to stay at home.
For me, that's the key point. So a lot of people on UC are in work. And actually, for me, the more important thing that we need to hold on to is if you give people the basics, so they're not in destitution, so they can actually afford the basics for a decent quality of life, you set the foundations for them to spring up. You set the foundations for them to do better. And if we had any doubt in our mind, actually furlough, that intervention that said, we are going to provide a baseline for people. And what did we see? People were able to engage with the labour market again. We didn't see huge levels of unemployment. People were able to bounce back. If you give people the foundations, they can get ahead. If you cut them at their knees, they tip into crisis and then they go into spiral. So I still don't understand our mindset on benefits because actually, for me, everything we've learned over the last 10 years should have shifted that mindset.
Right, at that point, let's pause. In a moment, we're going to talk about the sort of bigger social and economic picture, how we got here, and the kind of deep social issues that we probably didn't hear much about from Rishi Sunak.
Hold up. Hello, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland here. I now have my own US politics podcast, which is, helpfully, called Politics Weekly America. So if you want to hear my interviews with politicians like Hillary Clinton or expert analysis from Guardian journalists and the latest news from Washington, D.C. and beyond, you should subscribe. To do that, just type Politics Weekly America into Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be there every Friday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Welcome back. We're now going to talk about the big social and economic issues that leave so many people vulnerable to the current cost of living crisis and whether or not that big picture can be changed in any way. Clearly, this is a country full of millions of people who are extremely vulnerable to any rises in prices and big economic shocks. Since the financial crash of 2008, we've largely seen stagnating wages, benefits falling way behind living costs, millions of people living below the poverty line, and what you've ended up with is the plain fact that when we hit any crisis, a lot of people can't cope. Let's talk about the welfare state first of all. I think, anyway, the welfare system, the so-called welfare system, I prefer to call it social security personally, doesn't work. It's meant to exist as a safety net, but we all know, I think it's fair to say, that it pays people such paltry amounts of money that people live in an ongoing state of crisis. And it's plain, isn't it? You need a less miserly, more human welfare state. I mean, in Europe, they manage this. In Germany, if you lose your job, you get 60% of your previous average wage, up to a maximum of 7,050 euros per month in the west of Germany. And meanwhile, we pay people like a tenner a day to live on. There are issues here, David, and this is a relevant question to ask to you because you spent 6 months as the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. Did people in the Department of Work and Pensions talk about mounting poverty? I mean, a term like holiday hunger was in circulation, and I checked this, 2017, 2018.
You know, if you look at the record of successive governments, we've got a very high level of employment in the UK, and I think that's a good thing. I think
you know what I'm going to say to that? I mean, for example, 70% of children in poverty are from working families.
If you... I mean, partly because we have so many people in employment, you aren't going to, you know, no wonder the numbers have shifted in that direction. You know, we are getting people into work, which is good. I think there is a challenge, which is a lot of those people are in part-time work. And I think if you can extend the number of hours that they work, then that is one solution to that.
But at the very least, benefits need to be substantially increased so that if people lose their jobs, they're not therefore plunged into crisis and poverty.
There are absolutely structural issues. And for me, what's happening in the labour market and what's happening in our social security system sit hand in hand. And you can't get away from the fact that actually wages have stagnated, you know, and therefore living standards pretty much haven't budged for 10 years. At the very basics, there is a flaw that says the living wage is actually a real living wage and reflects the true cost of living. And then that starts pushing up wages across the income scale. I think I do believe that there is scope for greater worker voice and collective bargaining in order to ensure that the benefits, you know, from growth are better negotiated.
Do you, David, as a conservative? Because again, that seems to me something that runs across conservatives of all kinds. Is there a bit allergic to the idea of trade unions having a greater presence in people's working lives and people having more bargaining?
Yeah, I'm not sure that actually is the right answer. I'm afraid I don't believe that's
why,
the answer.
Why not?
Because I think the experience of, for example, the 1970s when we had a very strong trade union.
Oh, 40 or 50 years ago.
No, but... Well, that's the last time we had a really strong trade union.
But we have strange young trade union leaders across Europe, right? Okay. And they're able to have a corporatist model where they can sit down as grown-ups with employers and negotiate settlements that are good for workers.
Sweden and Germany are not Britain in the 1970s.
No, but that wasn't our experience in the 1970s. And what you saw is that essentially resources moved from... You know, unions were able to get very good deals for their members, and non-unionised, including low-paid people, tended to suffer as a consequence until the unionised areas became uncompetitive. And you know, that's why one of the reasons why they are no longer the force that they are.
David, you're in government. I know you're trying to do good things at the time, but the cut that we saw to Social Security over that 10-year period, I think, is unforgivable. And actually, if the Social Security system and the level of benefits that people are getting was anywhere close to the 2010 level, we would be in a situation where, you know, a couple with two kids would have £4,000 more in their pocket.
I think we also have to go back to the position that we were in 2010. And
I don't want to go.
I'm not going to go through the whole argument, John, but let me just. Make that point.
Thousands of occasions. Not me and you, but I mean down the years.
But, you know, there were some tough choices that any government was going to have to make in
those circumstances. On the backs of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged people in society.
The biggest single, you know, area of expenditure. You mentioned DWP, you know, that's the biggest spender in government. And inevitably there was gonna have to be something from that area. Now, you know, did we get everything right? I'm not gonna pretend that we did. Did we go too far, I think, in terms of the freeze? Yes. And are we doing enough now? I'm no longer obviously part of the government, but are we doing enough now? I don't think that we are.
See, the thing is, I would like to think the sort of naive, optimistic side of me would like to think we could at least have a conversation involving people from the left or the centre-left and the right or the centre-right of politics about the fact that clearly we can't go on like this. If there are people like Robin in Northampton and people like Lexi in North Wales and millions of other people living in impossible circumstances, clearly something very fundamental has to change, partly about the world of work and partly about the welfare state and the benefit system. Now, the last time there was a big, or one of the last times there was a big sort of sea change in that stuff was in 1945. And if you look back to what presaged that, it wasn't just the Labour Party. There were Conservatives involved in that sea change because there was a sense of, we can't go on like this. We'd seen the hunger and the poverty and the destitution of the 1930s, and right the way up to the King at the time, everybody agreed that something had to be done. Now, are we at least on the same page there, the three of us?
Well, I think
loaded question, some would ask.
Yes. Are we in that? Look,
But you agree, we can't. You can't live in a country as affluent as ours in which people are starving and freezing.
I think the government will regret not taking action now because I think it's going to be such a tough few months that the political pressure for them to do more is going to build up.
And where I think the debate needs to get to is to move, you know, so everyone will probably agree that we need short-term interventions. But for me, I think it is structural. You know, we've been arguing for what we call a living income, which is the kind of premise that there should be an income level, which we say as a society, no one's allowed to fall below, so that people can afford the basics. And then from there, they can build and they can get ahead. And actually, that is a really radical, controversial thing to say. And I'm like, what kind of a society are we, sixth richest, where to say there should be a basic income level that we say no one should fall below, is something that feels revolutionary. I don't think it does. And if you look around and you look at the state of the crisis that people are in, why on earth would that not be a thing that we should be trying to work on both sides of the political spectrum?
Where I think we differ, well, there's quite a few areas where we differ, but one area where I think I definitely differ is that I don't think you can guarantee income without conditionality.
And can you just be more specific? Yeah, when you say conditionality, like what?
So, which as a system works at the moment. So, you know, if you are receiving benefits, then yes, it's right that you are required to meet with your work coach, but you try and make that experience as much like work, because I do think you have to have a welfare system that is designed about, you know, providing support when people can't earn, but getting them back into the labour market as quickly as possible.
So I think that plays into this sort of scroungers narrative. And actually, there's no evidence that conditionality actually works. And every time the TWP is asked to stump up evidence about it, they shirk away from it. And in truth, most people want to work. Most people want to work. But if you actually equip them to engage in the labour market better, and that is both about the income that they get, that means that they can turn crappy jobs that don't pay them enough and pay poverty wages, and then you equip them with the skills in order to engage in the labour market, that will achieve the same outcome without being punitive.
This conversation could run and run, but I need to bring things to a close. I just wonder how you feel, just in conclusion, about the immediate political future. In the midst of the cost of living crisis and a looming energy shock and so on, there is an idea that we are definitely now in a new political era.
It is always uncomfortable for a government for there to be less money around, the choices become harder, people are grumpier, and some of that is bound to reflect on the government. So I think it's a difficult time. And if you like, the sort of economic cycle and the political cycle are misaligned for the government. You know, I'm really not sure that we're going to be kind of in boom time in 2024 and everyone's going to be happy.
It's a frightening time as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
It does feel like we're going from profound crisis to profound crisis. It feels like just a very uncertain, a really scary time. And a lot of things that we took for granted, I think, are being upended. And I think that will go back to, do we have a government for serious times? And, you know, do we have a prime minister for serious times? I would argue not. And I think the more we are in crisis mode, however much the prime minister tries to rebrand himself, I'm not sure that the public will be convinced that he's the guy to help us weather the storm.
I mean, I'm a journalist, you know. You're not meant to sort of feel anxious and terrified and depressed and all that. But obviously, if you're looking into this stuff, if you're talking to people having these experiences, that's exactly what happens, really. And the immediate future, leave aside politics, you know, the immediate future of people's everyday lives, I think is sort of terrifying. And there's a really, really sad quality to it as well. And I don't think politics has aligned itself with that on either side. I think this is true of the Labour Party as well. It's not really reflecting the gravity of what we're faced with. But British politics moves pretty slowly, always, you know. We're not the most...
Well, not always.
Well, we're not the most light on our feet political system, you know. We had the Great Depression in 1929, and then we got the Labour government and the post-war consensus in 1945. So I suppose that sort of informs my sense of anxiety, is that I actually feel optimistic in the back of my mind. I think over time things will change, because it seems to me that, as I said earlier, we can't go on like this. It's just a question of when that realisation conclusively will dawn. And I think that might be a fair way, even after 2024, when we'll all be 1p, or those of us who pay tax will be 1p in the pound richer. Thanks for that, Rishi. Thanks very much indeed. And on that note of gratitude, a fashionable emotion these days, we're going to call things to a close. Thank you so much for joining us today, Miatta and David.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And finally, don't forget to subscribe to Politics Weekly America with my Guardian colleague, Jonathan Friedland. This week, he's joined by two journalists in Florida for a very lively chat about Governor Ron DeSantis, the man who is trying to out-Trump Donald Trump. So you think we've got problems here? In the Republican Party. To get all the latest news from Washington and beyond, search for Politics Weekly America and hit subscribe. That's Politics Weekly America, out every Friday. This episode was brilliantly produced by Natalie Katena. Sound was by Ivan Manley. The executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back for more thrilling and lively discussion next Thursday. Thank you for joining us.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.